On this week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Brian Chee and Mr. Curtis Franklin joining me on the show today. Now, the EU has it out for Apple to comply with some device standards, and they aren't happy about it. Plus, business process automation is a challenging task. Well, today we have Danny Shaman, Machine Learning Product Manager of InRule, and he's going to talk us through the concept of AI to automate your processes and the concept of responsible and explainable AI. Definitely shouldn't miss it. Quiet on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 518, recorded November 4th, 2022. Skynet, Starlink to AI. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by OnLogic. OnLogic is helping innovators around the world solve their most complex technology challenges using OnLogic industrial computers, which are engineered for reliability, even in environments that would challenge or destroy traditional computer hardware. Learn more and find out about OnLogic's 30-day risk-free hardware trial by visiting onlogic.com/twit. And by Cisco, orchestrated by the experts at CDW. When you need to get more out of your technology, Cisco makes hybrid work possible. CDW makes it powerful. Learn more at cdw.com/Cisco. Welcome to TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through the big world of the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals and the experts, starting their very own and very busy senior analyst at Omdia. He's the man that has the pulse of the enterprise and security. He's Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, Maker Faire Orlando is here. How are things going there?
Maker Faire Orlando is indeed here. You can tell from the very subtle colored shirt that I'm wearing. I'm on the crew for Maker Effects is the group that produces it. We've been out there for 2.5 days already, getting ready for the fair. And boy, lots of exciting stuff going on. Lots of battling robots. We'll, by this evening, have a place to go into battle. We have all kinds of cosplayers and arcade players. We've got the vintage computer folks. It's just amazing, and it's wonderful being in the middle of that much creativity let loose upon the world. So I'm going to have fun this weekend and come out of it terribly exhausted but fully recharged.
Indeed. You had me at battling robots, so I'm sold on that one. So definitely looking forward to some of the coverage there. Fantastic. Well, speaking of looking forward, we also have looking forward to Mr. Brian Chee. He's back on the show as well. He's net architect of SkyFiber. He's a network expert, security professional, all-around tech geek, and he is also very busy at Maker Faire. Cheebert, how's it going on your side?
I'm actually having a lot of fun. One of the things that I'm actually really looking forward to is steamroller printing. One of our sponsors is a general construction company, and they have donated the use of one of their steamrollers. So Kurt and his lovely wife, Carol, did some laser cutting on some wood printing sheets, I guess you'd call them. Mm-hmm. And people are going to be able to go and ink them up, put a sheet of paper on it, and then have a steamroller go right over it, and they can take the prints home with them. That's going to be a lot of fun. And I've also been having a lot of fun working with the Central Florida Fairgrounds folks on helping them to upgrade their network. So if all goes well, next year I'll just be able to walk in and ask them, could you restore the Maker Faire profile for me? And I'm done. So maybe next year I could exhibit something I've created. Ought to be fun.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun. Well, I don't envy you guys on the sleep side of things, but I do envy you for seeing all this cool stuff. So enjoy the show. Well, speaking of busy, it's been a busy week in the enterprise, so we definitely should get started. The hardware market is definitely a hard one. Device companies are always under scrutiny to provide better and more compatible hardware. Apple is no exception here. Now, we're going to discuss a recent move by the EU to Apple to actually have them comply with more standards. Plus, artificial intelligence, sparks new markets, and it gives you the ability to do things at scale that you never dreamed of. Now, automating tasks is definitely one of those things. Well, today we have Danny Shaman. He's Machine Learning Product Manager of InRule. He's going to take us through the concept of AI to actually automate your business processes and the concept of responsible and explainable AI. So definitely shouldn't miss that. Definitely stick around. Lots of stuff to talk about. But first, like we always do, we have some enterprise tech news to talk about. So let's go ahead and jump into this week's news blips. It's hard not to talk about the latest news regarding Twitter that has just evolved over the last 2 days. Let's go over it. There's some speculation over the past several weeks whether Elon Musk would execute a plan to cut costs involving mass layoffs at Twitter. He began his reign at Twitter by firing several execs before November 1st. Now, since then, there was no news of additional layoffs, especially since the California WARN Act requires an ample notice of large layoffs. It was thought that the rest of the layoffs were just speculation. Unfortunately, Thursday evening, employees of Twitter noticed that they could no longer log into their devices or their Slack application. They then received an email from corporate saying they would be announcing layoffs early Friday morning over email. They either will stay or they'll go. They also closed all the corporate buildings and asked that people go home. In fact, the remaining people in the buildings were escorted out until further notice. Now, several people close to the process say the layoffs will be deep and broad and hitting almost half of the organization, nearly 3,700 people. Now, people were confused about the closing of the corporate buildings ahead of time as part of the process. Now, I've been through layoffs before. I can say that corporations do that to actually minimize things like corporate espionage and other issues related to disgruntled employees as part of that were impacted by the layoffs. It's unfortunate. It doesn't feel great. And I can tell you, it doesn't feel great to everyone in the business. And when you're escorted off the premises and you can't have access to corporate resources, it really creates a stressful situation for everyone. Now, starting late Thursday and into Friday, several Twitter employees impacted by the layoffs took to social media to talk about it. And once the email actually came out, those postings increased by a large factor. Now, there's a large spectrum of feelings from gratitude to actually disgruntled. In fact, some may be looking for legal retribution after the event. Now, people were not impacted. Those were not impacted by all of this also received an email from corporate thanking them for their service and letting them know that the change was coming to the corporate processes and Twitter itself, and that the buildings would be closed until further notice. Now, on a personal note, Twitter was not making money. In fact, they were losing money. Deep cuts so early on with a new regime doesn't look like tactical. It looks desperate. Now, reviewing all the business units at a large platform and a service company like Twitter takes time and it takes care. Personally, I don't think they gave enough time and attention to the process and the people. I feel that people who were impacted today, I feel for them and I wish them good luck. And the message to them is that this is not your end. This is just your beginning.
Well, just in case you're someone who still has romantic ideas about the sort of people engaged in cybercrime, I bring you this story from Dark Reading, based on reporting by the LA Times, showing just what fine, ideal-driven pirates these folks really are. Los Angeles Times reports that Cambodia, suffering economically because of the pandemic, has allowed Chinese mobsters to set up huge cybercrime operations using up to 100,000 people trafficked from across Asia, and they're doing it without consequence because of the revenue it generates for the country. The workers are lured by promises of good jobs, but when they arrive, their passports are seized and they're put to work in modern-day sweatshops running cybercrime campaigns. The Cambodian government admits to the 100,000 workers, but says that they're all there voluntarily to earn good livings in legitimate technology. Meanwhile, stories from those rescued from the criminal organizations include tales of beatings and torture for failing to meet quotas, and of being sold and passed around from gang to gang. Punishments for failing to meet quotas in cybercrime include such lovely actions as forced push-ups and squats, being tased, beaten, deprived of food, locked up in dark rooms, or worse. Now, international law enforcement is working to put an end to this, but the Cambodian government's cooperation with the criminals makes it tough. In the meantime, think about someone trapped in this scheme the next time you're inclined towards lenient attitudes for those convicted of so-called victimless white-collar cybercrime.
So, while this story started with Ars Technica, this has been a really big problem. The bottom line is that cable sub-oceanic cable companies hate laying deep ocean cable, and the cost skyrockets as it gets deeper. Not to mention, repairing a cable that has been broken, either from natural causes like underwater earthquakes, underwater volcanoes, or man-made idiots that are anchoring someplace they're not supposed to. Well, the Aloha Cabled Observatory that I worked on at the University of Hawaii actually used to be the AT&T HA4 cable. Was laid in the late 60s, early 70s. It got picked up by a U.S. Navy cable ship, but we had to do it before the cable got too deep, because as it gets deeper, it gets more expensive, and the U.S. Navy wasn't willing to give us carte blanche. Well, ship anchors dragging across cables as they reach shallower waters is the main reason, one of the biggest reasons, why marine authorities the world over have large areas of shallow waters marked as a no anchor zone. So as waters get shallower, so does the possibility of a ship dropping anchor someplace that could hook cables at various shallow water choke points, like in the Mediterranean, just off Egypt. Well, the article goes on to highlight that upwards of 100 cables annually get damaged or cut by various problems like anchors, underwater avalanches, or purposely cut by underwater demolition teams with the bad guys. Oh, by the way, this is also why cable landing sites are rarely marked on maps, to make it harder for people to play, you know, bad games on cutting cables on purpose, or threatening to, say, blow it up or drop something on it, you know, like an Acme safe, to destroy key cables and trying to blackmail people. Well, anyway. So some ask, oh, why don't you just use satellites? Oh, you can't. Those are harder to kill. Well, I ask, what kind of delay do you get when your signal has to go 10,000 miles for a round trip to orbit versus less than 1,000 miles on a terrestrial cable? Remember, latency matters. The point is that a huge number of our world's commercial transits underwater for underwater cables, and the Ars Technica folks mentioned that a full 17% of the world's current underwater cables transit the shallow waters off the Egyptian coast.
Supply chain attacks have been in the news a lot over the last several years, and more so over the infamous Log4j set of attacks. Now, these type of attacks are complex, they're hard to follow, and have broad impact across the industry. Threat actors are using it as a way to add ambiguity and complexity where organizations are weak in their processes. Now, according to this Bleeping Computer article, another threat is imminent. Threat actors are using the compromised infrastructure of an undisclosed media company to deploy the Sockgalish JavaScript malware framework, also known as fake updates, on the websites of hundreds of newspapers across the U.S. Now, the threat actor behind this supply chain attack, tracked by Proofpoint as TA569, has injected malicious code into benign JavaScript files that gets loaded by the news outlets' websites. And the malicious JavaScript file is used to install Sockgalish, which will infect those who visit the compromised websites with malware payloads camouflaged as fake browser updates delivered as zip archives. So you could get an example of chrome.update.zip or firefox.update.zip, with actually are alerted of these updates. Now, in total, the malware has been installed on sites belonging to more than 250 U.S. news outlets, some of them being major ones, according to the security researcher. Now, what does this mean for your organization? Well, first, ensure that the updates being installed are regulated by policies that you put down, and only updates that are approved should get processed. Good rule to follow there. If it's not possible, your first line of defense is user education. That will ensure that people who can go and identify weird behavior like this when they visit news sites don't install the updates. It also means that supply chain attacks will continue to be a threat until we find a way to cut the attack vector off at the knees. Now, let's hope recent moves by organizations to be more strict on consuming updates and dependencies will at least slow down the threat a little bit. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have the news bites But before we get to the news bites, we do have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's OnLogic. Now, you're probably more than just a few feet away from a personal computing device that's really changed your life. I know I am. Right behind me here. There's an entire hidden world of computing that's revolutionizing sustainable agriculture, bringing smart cities to life, and increasing manufacturing efficiency to improve the quality of our lives. And that's where you'll find OnLogic's distinctive Orange industrial and embedded computers. Now, OnLogic is the first choice in industrial computing for innovators worldwide who need computing power that can survive and thrive where traditional hardware might actually fail. Now, OnLogic designs and creates computing solutions that can fit in the palm of your hand while empowering everything from advanced robotics and AI to manufacturing automation, digital media solutions, and smart agricultural technologies. Engineered specifically for reliability, many OnLogic computers are passively cooled and ventless, protecting internal components from dust and other airborne contaminants. Now, the removal of the fans also results in a completely solid-state device to protect against shock and vibration. Now, other design features and specialized components protect systems from extreme temperatures and interference as well. Now, OnLogic systems are extensively tested to operate reliably wherever they're needed, whether they're monitoring a remote mining operation or riding on medical cart at a hospital. The team at OnLogic truly cares about creating right-fit solutions tailored specifically to solve your unique technology challenges. Now, OnLogic partners with leading software companies like AWS to enable rapid evaluation and deployment of edge computing solutions. Now, for example, OnLogic's line of AWS IoT Greengrass compatible computers has been vetted by AWS, bringing you peace of mind that it will work right out of the box. Now, if you need a computing solution that can be easily configured to your particular needs, supported by industry experts who are just a phone call away, website chat, or email away, and it's delivered quickly, the team at OnLogic is ready to help you. Get started and learn more about OnLogic's 30-day risk-free hardware trial. Visit onlogic.com/twit. That's onlogic.com/twit. And we thank OnLogic for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, proprietary I/O and power ports have been the name of the game for a long time for device manufacturers. However, you may have been seeing the broad impact that the market has had. That Apple's had on the market, and most of the eyes are on them. Apple has had their proprietary Lightning connector port for, let's say, over 10 years now, and they've made a lot of profit from it, from those custom specs that are out there and cables that they're selling. Although organizations and people grumble about it, they buy it anyways. They don't push back. Well, until now, the European Union strikes again, and this time they're requiring that specific devices have a more standardized port like USB-C. As Ars Technica article points it out, the EU put the final approval into the common charger law that will require all devices within specific categories, smartphones included, to standardize on USB-C. Now, most devices have already gone that way, including Apple's MacBook and iPad lines, but the iPhone line is stuck with Apple's proprietary Lightning connector. My guess is because they don't want to go and retool all of their manufacturing processes for the phone, especially this part of the how the economy is doing, and especially all the costs of updating their manufacturing plants. Not only does that open the door to more options for organizations, consumers in the EU, some believe that this will actually be less e-waste because of it. Apple doesn't seem to agree here. Now, my point of view is that they go to USB-C, it actually opens the door to a number of large number of third-party solutions for charging and for data, which could actually can cause some unforeseen consequences when supporting the devices. However, standards are good, and ensuring that consumers and organizations have options allows for broader ecosystems, and it also brings down the cost. I want to bring my co-host in here because I'm sure that they have several different points of view here. What do you guys think? Is the decision here going to impact the market in any way? What do you think, Curtis?
Well, in terms of moving the needle on sales one way or the other, I don't think so. It might boost sales of Lightning to USB transition cables, but that's about it. I'm not a fan of highly prescriptive legislation and rulemaking. What if the EU had existed and had mandated that we all do DB25 for our charging ports? We would now be dealing with phones that are the size of cigarette cases. I just don't know that it's a good thing to do. Are standards good? Sure. Should standards be mandatory? I'm not convinced, at least not at this level. So I don't see that it has any tremendously harmful effects, but I'm not a big fan of going about it this way.
Right. What about you, Chibert? It seems strange that Apple will have to go retool themselves to do all this work. You think that they'll just do it for the EU and restrict it only there and still sell the remaining backlog of inventory of Lightning stuff to the rest of the world?
Let's take a look at that first statement. Retooling. Now, I don't know if you've ever been involved with a device that has a radio in it. Getting it FCC certified or EU certified is difficult. And anytime you change any perforations of your shielded case, it's almost black magic to retune the RF envelope. Someone near and dear to our good friend Padre actually works on the Apple RF envelope. And he said sometimes just moving a hole in an RF cage, just a fraction of an inch, we're talking about moving it sub millimeters, will be all that's necessary to get it to pass or fail certain tests. Now, as far as some of the other comments in this article, e-waste. Well, if all of a sudden the most popular phone on Earth, and I believe it still is, changes its interface, that means all the Lightning devices that people have, and a lot of us have, I've got a ton of them, are now becoming e-waste. It's going to be a flood. Maybe in the long run, a USB-C would be great. Yeah, there you go. I happen to really like USB-C, but the Lightning's been around. It is a hermaphroditic cable, meaning you can plug it in either way, just like the USB-C. I think my only complaint about the Lightning is it doesn't have enough ground lines. So powering high-powered devices is actually kind of hard. So USB-C is better there. But let's tell a really short version of this story. Mandating an actual interface has a lot of interesting ramifications. Having been with the United States government and working in some interesting environments, there were lots of cases where the government mandated certain things. Let's put it this way. We still use paper tape on some devices in the classified world, and that's because of someone mandating that paper tape must be supported. And it is still supported 30 years later. Is that what's going to happen to USB-C? I say it's great to mandate that we go to a common interface someday, but I think the EU is being silly in trying to name USB-C, because maybe someday soon there's going to be a USB D or E or F. And if they've mandated USB-C, the rest of the world will just wave at the European Union and say, nanny, nanny, boo, boo.
Right, right. Yeah, USB 4 is coming along. I've noticed a lot of smaller companies out of Taiwan and so on building out these solutions. So we'll see how this evolves. Well, I think that one puts that one to bed. Thank you, guys. I want to talk about the next one, because this next one's pretty interesting as well. Starlink is known for satellite internet for people and organizations, but drones? What's going on there, Chibert?
All right. Let's tell you another story. There's been lots and lots of things written about the United States reconnaissance drone, or actually drone fleet, that they're flown out of the desert in the middle of the United States, and they go over a satellite into the drone. And one of the challenges is the delay between when you flip your wrist on the joystick and the ailerons on the drone actually move. Well, and that's with dedicated satellites that were custom built just for the military, just to fly drones. There might be other things on there, but we're talking about billions, maybe trillions of dollars spent on the U.S. drone fleet. Way, way out of the price range for the commercial world. Because, gee, sometimes you need to do surveys in the deep desert or over the Arctic or in the middle of the ocean over, say, a new island coming up, where there are no cellular connections, there are no terrestrial ways of connecting to some sort of radio. But Starlink opens up a really interesting possibility. So while it's probably not going to be that, you know, little consumer quadcopter that you see there, it might look something more like that quadcopter, where it will have some specialized radios on it so it can take advantage of the ultra low latency of Starlink in LEO, low Earth orbit, and allows you to go and with relatively low delay be able to remote view. Because, you know, there's a lot of times where a drone will just be mowing the lawn, doing GPS waypoints, and you might go right past something really, really interesting. Maybe that big gold deposit in the Arctic. Well, if someone's actually flying it and looking at the instruments, they can react in real time and go back and go, wow, that's really cool. We would have missed that, and we would have lost all those advantages. Well, so an Ontario company called Ardars had a successful integration of Starlink into their drone system, and it allows them to do some really interesting things. Well, one of the main issues facing commercial drone operations is communications outside of urban areas where maintaining sufficient internet connectivity may be challenging, according to Ardars. To overcome this challenge, the company has been looking at integrating satellite modems into its drone system, but according to Ardars, the equipment is costly and only supply limited bandwidth. While Starlink, on the other hand, uses its own satellite dishes to receive high-speed internet with download rates as high as 350 megabits per second. Now, one of the things they don't mention is the low latency, because they're in low Earth orbit, which is the name of the game with drones. Well, lots of interesting things. Now, this is going to be one of those good thing, bad thing, you know, two sides of the coin. If it's a commercial system and anyone can go and buy it, that means, gee, the entry level for military drones, say for both good guys and bad guys, gets a lot lower. And as you can see from the conflict, let's actually call it a war in the Ukraine, the Ukrainians are using commercial drones and being able to do some really, really interesting things and really frustrating the Russian army. Well, if they can fly them using the SpaceX Starlink system, gee, that's going to be interesting. So some of the other things, you know, obviously is surveying. Whether you're looking for, you know, natural resources, you know, gas, oil, and so forth. I think I'm going to stop yakking, and I'm going to go and toss this over to Kurt and start talking about, you and I have both talked to people like oil companies, and the cost of surveying is astronomical. What do you think? You know, having real-time control of drones and real-time surveying of really remote areas, I got to imagine corporate America or corporate world is really interested in this. What do you think?
I think the world, the corporate world will certainly be interested, because this should allow for a much better surveying of natural resources, whether we're talking about timber, water, doing various research, looking for rare earth minerals, all kinds of things. So no question that there's going to be a great deal of interest from the corporate world. I think there will also be a great deal of interest, as you pointed out, from the research world. Everything from natural resources to archaeology. Imagine being able to fly LIDAR emitting drones over areas that have never been fully surveyed before. Now, there are lots of good reasons for this. Now, are there some potential misuses? Sure, there are. But I think that on the whole, the real possibilities of technology like this far exceed any dangers that we might see. You know, it's only been 15 years or so that we were able to say that less than half the people on Earth had made a phone call, you know, much less been able to get access to the internet. And we're seeing huge leaps in connectivity and what's possible, not only in areas where the infrastructure is currently well developed, but in areas where the infrastructure is going to be space-based. And that has the potential to change an awful lot of things in a big hurry. I'm excited by this, and I think that if I were engaged in certain types of research off the beaten track, I would be even more excited.
Super cool. So, Lou, what do you think? You know, you're kind of in, you know, the DevOps, you know, your feet are in the DevOps world. What do you think? You know, we're going to be talking to a guest about AI. Gee, what do you think? You think maybe we're going to be able to start seeing automated surveying that has an AI driving this to go and look for things? And then, so that way you don't have people going cross-eyed, staring at a screen for hours on end. You know, what do you think? You think that's far-fetched?
I don't think so. I think, you know, we already see a lot of Google's recent AI investments on doing things like looking for, you know, watching wildfires or, you know, these types of things. I can almost apply these types of things to the drone side of things as well, where, you know, you can now have more of a visibility into it by, you know, having devices like drones be able to survey areas for things like wildfires, for things like flooding, for, you know, for better access to oil drilling and oil drilling sites. And we still have, you know, still have connectivity to those drones. I think there's a, you know, a million and one applications that can happen here. And I think, you know, by looking at what a lot of companies are already doing in the AI space, this will just extend their extremities, their arms out even farther, because now they have physical access to those sites to gain even more data, to produce more insights. So I feel like this is just the tip of the iceberg for that. And we'll probably see companies like the Googles of the world, the Microsofts of the world, doing things like this once they have that physical access.
Awesome. You know, that's just awesome. I'm looking forward to it. I really am. There's all kinds of possibilities when communications gets cheap and ubiquitous. But, you know, we're going to have to see. You know, the SpaceX people need to go and play nice with the, you know, the developers. The antennas need to get smaller and a little less like sails for it to work nicely on a drone. And, you know, maybe, just maybe, we'll kick off a brand new industry. Anyway, we can all dream. But, you know, I think it's time to go to a guest. But don't we have an ad first?
It is indeed. Is it indeed. Well, yes, before we get to our guest, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Cisco, orchestrated by the experts at CDW. The helpful people at CDW understand that hybrid work continues to evolve and that your organization must evolve with it to succeed. Now, with so many remote collaboration options, you need a strong and consistent network to empower your workforce and keep them together. Consider a Cisco hybrid work solution designed and managed by CDW experts to deliver the same quality network experience to all of your offices, even your satellite ones, connecting your team from pretty much anywhere. Now, because Cisco networking keeps things flowing smoothly and securely with embedded security, compliance, and multi-factor authentication that protects collaboration among your spread out team. Now, with real-time visibility into distributed applications, security, user, and service performance, you get better line of sight into how your network is operating and how better to grow your organization. And Cisco networking levels the playing field, providing access to flexible, high-end collaborative experiences that create an inclusive work environment. When you need to get more out of your technology, Cisco makes hybrid work possible. CDW makes it powerful. Learn more at cdw.com/Cisco. And we thank Cisco, orchestrated by CDW, for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show. We actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twyatt Riot. Today we have Danny Shaman. He's Machine Learning Product Manager of InRule. Welcome to the show, Danny.
Hey, good afternoon.
So, you know, before we get into the thick of it, we have a lot of interesting topics here and a lot of stuff to talk about for our audience. But before we get to that, we do want to talk about your origin story. Our audience loves to hear people's journey through tech. What was your journey through tech? What brought you to InRule?
Sure. So I probably have a bit of a non-standard career path compared to probably many of your guests. I spent 7 years as a equities trader on the floor of the Chicago Stock Exchange before going back to school at that point and finishing a bachelor's degree in political science. Preceding that, I grew up, you know, very fortunate to have parents who were both small business owners that used computers. They brought computers into the home very early. I had a 386 that I was, you know, cranking away on a three-color monitor and, grew from there. I was always deeply engrossed in technology. Started cutting my chops programming, mostly doing video game mods and the like as a kid. Graduated high school, went off to study computer engineering, and about a year into it, realized that spending my life writing code in front of a computer was probably not for me. Left and pursued a career in karate. Was training to be a member of the U.S. National Karate Team at that point and teaching karate. And ended up stumbling my way into finance from there and spent 7 years there. Finished my degree up at Northwestern at mostly through night classes and graduated with a degree in political science. And coming out of that, got a position doing technical writing for a machine learning startup called SimMachines. They had a focus in explainable machine learning. They have a proprietary similarity search engine. And ended up getting offered a job as a solution architect with them, grew from there, and then InRule Technology acquired SimMachines about a year and a half ago and joined InRule.
It's amazing. That's an amazing story. I love that. I love people who are, you know, start out on one side and go to the other side, you know, and so that's amazing. That's an amazing story. Thank you for that. So I want to talk a little bit about process automation because we talk a lot about this on the show. We talk about robotic process automation, business process automation, and, you know, kind of the difference between them. Now, we see a lot of, you know, on the side of RPA, the robotic process automation, about just, using machine learning and AI to help you with, you know, smaller tasks, repetitive tasks. But business process automation is a lot harder because it requires a lot more data points to go figure out how to automate an entire business process across, you know, multiple different parts of your organization, that kind of thing. What are you seeing in this space? What is InRule doing that is different from the rest?
Sure. So we've really joined three technologies that are usually thought of as being somewhat distinct, which is business process automation, decision automation, and machine learning, or and in our case specifically, explainable machine learning. And on the business process automation side, you know, as you mentioned, one of the big difficulties is that companies have a vast number of discrete, disparate systems that are often not networked with each other, you know, no relevant APIs or anything like that. And so business process automation in many ways gives you the tool to connect those systems, to create the interfaces that you need to move between them, create tracking systems to measure behaviors moving within and between systems, and letting you consolidate your processes into really like a single system versus having, you know, hey, we're doing customer onboarding. Step one is I remember which Excel file we keep our, you know, employee account numbers in, so I can go and update that. Like that's that's the process.
True. People do that.
Nominal amount of organizations, yeah. And it's just like no, yeah. Like you can standardize most of what you do on a regular basis, and you should. And so we provide tools to enable companies to do that.
Now, it's interesting because we see a lot of organizations, obviously some organizations are moving a lot of their software and services into one place where they have a lot of end-to-end solutions. Like I see, obviously I work at Microsoft. I see a lot of organizations moving to the M365 world because they can live and have their data all and all their processes all in one spot. And that's kind of the, you know, the marketing way of me saying, hey, that makes it easy for you to build out process automation there. But, you know, you work with a lot of organizations that don't live in one cloud or don't have data in one spot or don't have software in one spot. How is InRule helping those organizations?
Yeah. So you end up with a wide variety of disparate systems. As you were saying, there's very much a need to establish connectivity into a central point. So you end up with systems that are basically routers for you. And you know, you can bring those together to consolidate information, to bring your data together, to make it accessible. There's a relatively new concept called the data lakehouse that has very much been taking off. And that's, you know, the idea that wherever your data lives, you have some mechanism to consolidate it to one place so that you can tend to it and digest it and leverage it.
Right. So we talk a lot about, you know, the use of AI and machine learning in this side of things. You know, what are you guys using as like the data points for this, and how are you kind of utilizing ML and AI to kind of make this easier to have better goals for organizations and especially in process automation side of things?
Yeah. So we actually provide a data agnostic machine learning tool. So I'm the product manager for a tool that we call the ML Studio. It is an application within the InRule ecosystem for building, deploying, maintaining explainable machine learning models. The data that you want to drive into an ML use case, the data that you want to drive into an ML model is extremely use case specific. We do a lot of work in fraud detection, for example. We've also got major deployments in silico drug discovery. Obviously the data that you'd want to drive one versus the other is entirely different. So it's a, you know, bring your own data, and you know, then we provide the tools for data manipulation and application from there.
Right. Now, a lot of organizations, obviously, they think about, okay, well, this company is using machine learning and AI. You know, are they using it in a responsible manner? Obviously, we've heard a lot of things in the news around. In fact, I just read a survey. that came from your site. It was a survey commissioned by Forrester that talked about this. You know, what are organizations worried about there, and how's Enroll kind of focusing on that?
Yeah, so machine learning, you have these systems that are self-optimizing functions, basically. It's, you say, here's a bunch of data. Here's the thing that I care about. What if this data is important for reaching this outcome? And then you say, you know, machine learning system, like, go wild, learn the you know, figure out the absolute best way to do that. Now, potential issues with that are, you know, the machine learning model sees the data that you provided it as the entire universe. It doesn't know that there's a single person outside of the data set that you've provided. It doesn't know what gravity is. It doesn't know anything about anything about except for what you're telling it. Now, if what you're telling it is biased in some way, like, you know, almost every human touched process, your machine learning model is going to learn that bias and it's going to amplify that bias. Typically in society, we agree that having bias against certain groups of people is undesirable, and we've got regulations and laws against that. And also, because it's, you know, negatively perceived, there's major reputational risk in releasing a model that is harmfully biased towards people, especially protected classes.
Right. Right. We were kind of talking about this before the show, and you know, we talked a little bit about the Twitter layoffs that are happening, and it seems like you know the whole concept of ethical, the ethics process of machine learning and AI, Twitter was directly impacted by this. How do you see this kind of going on that side? Do you see this as a terrible thing?
Yes. As one takeaway from this podcast, if any of your listeners walk out of here and they're like, wow, we've got this whole AI practice and we haven't considered the ethics of it at all, and you're like, really need to go and bring an AI ethicist onto your team. Twitter did, my understanding is that they fired their entire AI ethics team, which had been probably the best in corporate in corporate tech. So that's, they're available for work. Right. But I think it's a really strong indication on the need for regulation. This follows Google's ethical AI team imploding last year after they refused to allow a researcher to publish their work because it was minorly critical. I think it really speaks to the fact that we can't count on these companies that are spending millions to billions of dollars on AI practice to police themselves. Right. There's a very real need for governments to step in and put some guidelines in place.
Right. Well, I do want to bring my co-host back in because they're chomping at the bit here and behind the scenes in the chat. I want to bring you guys back in. Curtis, bring him back in first.
Sure. Happy to do so. And one of the things that I'm really interested in is your take on the blueprint for the AI Bill of Rights that the White House has put forward. First of all, do you think we need some sort of AI Bill of Rights? And is it the sort of thing that could be effective if it was all voluntary? Or are we going to need something that has some enforcement teeth behind it?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, the AI is really, it's not even the AI Bill of Rights. It was like a blueprint for the AI Bill of Rights.
Right.
And that's because it doesn't have any real teeth to it right now. It was, you know, an executive branch proposed initiative that, you know, many executive branch agencies are going to set out to follow. There's nothing really holding their feet to the fire. It's got a bunch of recommendations that, you know, that they say corporations should follow as well. Of course, without legislation to back it, no real teeth for it there either. But that said, a rights-oriented framework that lays out the sorts of protections that people should expect when they interact with technologies like this provides, you know, it provides a nice framework to see where the, you know, what sorts of legislation could be passed to have a positive effect. And I don't think that any of the proposals in the blueprint were overly onerous. And I anticipate that we will start seeing more, you know, actual legislation in this area. We've been seeing that starting in the EU with the AI Act. We're seeing a little bit in the US, like the city of New York has legislation protecting or rather mandating harmful bias audits in machine learning models that are being used for employment decisions. And I expect that to continue to grow.
Well, you know, I tend to agree with you on all those points. And I'd like to loop back as well to talk about something that you touched on. You know, we have seen a number of instances where AI that was based on a limited model had negative repercussions for members of underrepresented groups. And it seems to me that in addition to that, that if you have limited models, if you base your machine learning or AI processing on models that come from one point of view, you really are limiting yourself into what that system can do for you. So how important do you think it is that we somehow get more diversity in the teams that are building these models? Because it can, you know, it can be difficult for a team to go outside its own experience in figuring out how to build a more complex and more complete model. First of all, do you think it's an issue? And second, is it an issue worth addressing within the industry?
Yeah, so there's a couple pieces there that I'd like to address. The first one is around the scale of the models. You know, you mentioned the limited point of view of the models, the relatively limited data. You know, you're never going to have a AI model that has a perfect understanding of the world, right? Like there's, you know, you need some deterministic recording of, you know, every atom in the universe. Like it's, you can't do it. There's always going to be something that's going to go wrong. And so, you know, what you end up having are these ML models that are, you know, very narrowly optimized and tailored for very specific problems. They're trained on very, you know, relatively narrow data, as you mentioned. And that can result in either cases where your ML model is going to be deployed in situations where it doesn't have good data because that's relatively limited. And that can be very hard to understand as the creator of a model, the range of use cases down the line where the model's going to get used in. And so to that extent, or to address that, there need to be some very real limitations that model creators put in place in terms of where and how models can be used to ensure that they're only actually being used for the cases that they were trained for. You need observability into how they're being used so that you can ensure that they're not being used harmfully. But then the other side of that is you need to ensure that you're collecting data that's accurate, that's relevant, that's kept up to date. And that can be extremely difficult as well. You end up, if you look at a lot of these like generative language models that have been coming out, the BERTs and the like, if you look at the releases for those, all of those companies say, hey, we trained this on some massive corpus of data that wasn't especially clean, and we know that there are harmful biases in this model, and we're leaving it up to you. Like, sorry. And I don't think that's sustainable. I'm surprised that these companies' legal teams are signing off on it. But that's the current state.
Okay. I'd like to get you to speculate a little. One of the conclusions that we've kind of come to over the years that we've been watching the no-code, low-code, a revolution, I guess you can call it. And the trick is a lot of that's being driven because of frustration with the entire DevOps process. You know, we're not being able to get it done fast enough. Well, getting AI into the business automation feels like this might be also being driven by some of those same market pressures. And I'd like you to speculate, it feels like we're running headlong into this. What should people really be doing? What are the milestones? What are the stop signs that people should really consider before they jump off this cliff?
So I'll preface this by saying that InRule is a low-code platform, so I have a bit of a horse in this race. A good chunk of the advantage of machine learning is that you can tell the system to go and optimize on its own. You don't need to sit there and have and write a rules-based system to go, and granularly try and improve it over time and spend months building it up only for what you're modeling to change over time as well. So from that perspective, machine learning can be a massive time saver in getting effective models out the door. At the same time, we're seeing, and this is again the work that I do, we're seeing a lot of effort going into reducing the complexity and effort required to actually build a machine learning model. To again, kind of do this DevOps end run around needing to actually get developers, or in this case, data scientists involved in the actual model creation. Our intention is to give users, regardless of whether they're, PhD data scientists who we have as users, or people like me who have a bachelor's degree in political science, the ability to build the models that they need for themselves and not need to go and wait for an opening on their data science team so that they can, kick off some new internal POC around that.
Well, okay. Now, I'm a small to medium business. I'm thinking this might help my bottom line. What kinds of homework should I be doing? What kinds of things should I be looking up, quantifying, cataloging before we give a company like InRule a ring?
So I think there's kind of two ways to look at this problem. Almost every machine learning project and every machine learning problem that I've run into has come back to data availability. And so if you're a company that's thinks that they need to get into this game and haven't been there, I think step one is to look at the data that they have that they've collected and consider what that could be used to drive in terms of models. The flip side of that is to say, hey, I have, a problem with a business problem. I don't have a good way to address it. Machine learning seems like it should be, machine learning or automation seem like they could address this for me, and then, you know, sit down and work out what data they need to drive that. But to me, it really boils down to data availability there.
Well, it's amazing how time flies when you're having fun. Danny, it's great to have you on the show. We're running a little low on time, but we did want to maybe give the folks at home some more information about InRu. Where can they go to learn more and maybe how their organization get started?
InRule.com. Absolutely. If you need to automate your business, if you need to make better decisions faster, give us a ring.
Thanks again for being here. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best enterprise and IT podcast in the universe. So definitely tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-hosts. Starting with the round, Mr. Brian Chibert, what's going on for you in the coming weeks? Where can people find you, and where can people find you at Maker Faire?
Well, I'm actually going to be running around like a chicken without a head at Maker Faire, fixing things. I just found out that one of the new policies of the fairgrounds is to run a captive portal to get you to go and say, yes, we agree to, you know, such and such, you know, terms. It breaks IoT left and right. So we're got to work on turning that off, at least for the fair. But, you know, I'm going to throw out some, you know, I like complaining. You know, there's all kinds of things I talk about that I've run into, and I like to share my experiences. And a lot of the sharing I do on Twitter. For Twitter, I am ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. And we'd love to hear your ideas. We'd love to hear your comments. You can hear me ranting. Sometimes I rant at my friends, you know. Lots of fun. You hear me ranting at Padre every once in a while, and even though Padre's in Rome. But you know what? You, the viewer, have sent me all kinds of interesting ideas. Some of the ideas have come via email. I'm Chebert, spelled Cheebert at twit.tv. You're also welcome to send email to twite@twit.tv, and that'll hit all the hosts. Would love to hear your ideas. Love to hear your comments.
Thank you, Chebert, for being here. Well, we also have to thank our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming week? Where could people find you, and where could people find you at Maker Faire?
Well, after I get finished with things like steamroller printing and welcoming people to the Maker Effects booth, that's the Maker Space and the foundation that produce Maker Faire. I get back to work next week, working on various research into the human side of security, starting to look at some risk issues and quantifying that risk. In addition, I've got some research going on the use of AI in security, and a bunch of other things. So follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA. And come on over to darkreading.com/Omdia, where you'll find the things that I write and the things that my colleagues write. You know, one of the things we're very proud of at the Omdia cybersecurity practice is that we put together an incredible team during a pandemic. Not at all easy to do, but we've got a whale of a group of individuals over there. So please come on over and check us out.
Thank you, Curtis, for being here. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise and IT news. Go to our show page right now. That's right. Twitter. twit.tv/Twyatt. There you will find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, co-host information, guest information, of course, the links of the stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. That's right there. You support the show by getting your audio version, your video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your podcast applications or any one of your devices, because we're on all of them. So definitely check it out and subscribe and support the show. Plus, you may have also heard, that's right, we also have Club Twit as well. It's a members-only ad-free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus feed that you can't get anywhere else. And it's only $7 a month. And then you'll get a lot of great things about, you know, there's lots of great things that come with Club Twit. One of them is the exclusive access to the members-only Discord server. Chat with the hosts, the producers. You can have separate side discussions and all the great channels that are on there. Plus, they also have special events. Lots of fun stuff there. So definitely check out Club Twit. Join Club Twit. Be part of the movement. Go to twit.tv/Club Twit. Now, Club Twit also offers corporate group plans as well. It's a great way for you to give access to our ad-free tech podcasts. And the plans start with 5 members at a discounted rate of $6 each per month. You can add as many seats as you like for your organization. And this is a great way for your IT department, your developers, your sales team, your tech teams to stay up to date with access to all of our podcasts. And just like the regular membership, you can get access to the Twit Discord server as well and get that Twit Plus bonus feed as well. So definitely check out Club Twit, twit.tv/Club Twit. And after you subscribe, please impress your friends, your family members, and your coworkers with the gift of Twiet, because we talk a lot about some fun tech topics on this show, and I guarantee they will find it fun and interesting as well. So definitely have them subscribe and support the show as well. It's holiday time, so definitely give the gift of Twiet. Now, after you subscribed and you're available, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time on Fridays, we do this show live at live.twit.tv. Check that out. Come see how the pizza's made, all the behind the scenes, all the fun stuff, all the banter that we do before and after the show as well. So come check out the live stream at live.twit.tv. But of course, you got to jump into the chat room live as well. irc.twit.tv. We have all the returning characters in there as well as a lot of new characters each and every week. We get a lot of tech topics in there, lots of great questions. Really great people in there. So definitely check out the chat room as well. If you can watch the show live, irc.twit.tv. And I want you also hit me up on Twitter at twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my enterprise tidbits. Also, you can hit me up on LinkedIn at Louis Maresca. I'm the Louis, only Louis Maresca on there other than my dad. But, you know, hey, you know, he doesn't post at all. And of course, direct message me, whether it's on Twitter or LinkedIn, and let's have some good conversations. And, you know, give me some show ideas, give me some, you know, topics to talk about on the show. Maybe just talk about tech in general. So definitely hit me up there. If you want to know what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft, definitely check out developers.microsoft.com/office. There it is. It shows you the latest and greatest ways for you to customize your Office experience to make it more productive for you, whether you want to create macros for your Excel documents that are cross-platform that run in Power Automate. You can do that with the latest and greatest Office scripts that's on there. A lot of great stuff. So definitely check it out to help your organization be more productive. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we couldn't do the show without them. So thank you for all their support over the years. Also, thank you to all the engineers and staff at Twit. We definitely couldn't do the show without them. Of course, thank you to Mr. Brian Chi. He's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer as well. He does all the bookings and the plannings for the show, and we really couldn't do the show without him. So thank you, Chibert, for all your support over the years. Of course, before we sign out, we also have to thank the editor that's going to edit the show after the fact. You're going to remove all of my mistakes. So thank you for all your support. And plus, I also thank our editor, our TD for today, our technical director, Mr. Ant Pruitt. He's the talented Ant Pruitt. He does an amazing show called Hands-On Photography, which I watch each and every week. And, you know, I'm always curious what's on the next episode. What's going on this week in Hands-On Photography, Ant?
Hey, Mr. Lou, thank you for the support, sir. This week, I dive into a question that I've gotten a gazillion times over the last couple of weeks, and that's photo restoration, because I think people are trying to get some gifts ready for the holiday season. And I'll be honest with you, I tried to talk people out of doing it. It's a lot. It's a lot of hard work, and it ain't for the faint of heart, but check it out, twit.tv/HOP for Hands-On Photography.
That's amazing. Well, you know, restoration's also great for a lot of old photos too. So I'm definitely interested in that. So I will definitely check that out. Thank you, Ann. Well, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
If you are looking for a midweek update on the week's tech news, I got to tell you, you got to check out Tech News Weekly. See, it's all kind of built in there with the title. You get to learn about the news in tech that matters. Every Thursday, Jason Howell and I talk to the people making and breaking the tech news, get their insights and their interesting stories. It's a great show to check out. twit.tv/TNW.